Sue is a member of our church, and she went on a big adventure this past summer, and she's going to tell us as much as we need to know for now. Welcome, Sue.
Good morning. Just before I get into my talk about what actually happened on the walk I participated in, I wanted to give you a little bit of background on what Parkinson's disease actually is. Many people, when they think of Parkinson's, think of an old man shaking. And although there are lots of older men who have Parkinson's, it affects a much wider demographic than that. It's a neurodegenerative disorder. It is progressive, and there is no cure. The most common symptoms are tremor, slowness and stiffness, impaired balance, and rigidity of muscles. Although there are lots of other symptoms, including fatigue, problems with speech, handwriting, stooped posture, gastrointestinal problems, and sleep disturbances. The frustrating thing about Parkinson's is that you can't predict, even if you're told you have Parkinson's, which of those symptoms you're going to get, what the timeline is going to be like. And so it's very, very difficult to plan as an individual with Parkinson's what things are going to be like 6 months from now, a year from now, because you really don't know. So with that in mind, I'm going to tell you a little bit about some adventures I've been lucky enough to take part in over the past 12 months. Just over a year ago, a friend sent me a Facebook post about a fundraiser for Parkinson's disease that was in the planning stages, and this goes to show the power of social media. She did not know that I had Parkinson's disease at the time, and when I read the post, I was instantly intrigued. It was about a man named Harry McMurtry, who it turns out is, well, I knew he was from Toronto, I didn't know him personally. Many of you may know his parents or his siblings, there are six of them, so they've got lots of McMurtrys around. But Harry was diagnosed with early onset Parkinson's when he was 40, and that was 14 years ago. So he's been living with it a long time. And after leaving his career as a lawyer, he underwent deep brain stimulation surgery at the Toronto Western Hospital and has since moved to New York to live with his wife, Deb. Harry decided that he wanted to do something to give back to the Parkinson's community and was planning a walk from New York to Toronto to unite his two hometowns in an effort to raise money and awareness for and about Parkinson's disease. When I read the post, I immediately sent Harry a message. And in that message, I introduced myself. I told him that I thought what he was doing was amazing, but that he really did need a woman to walk with him to show the true face of Parkinson's and sort of underscore the fact that it doesn't discriminate by gender or by age. And somehow I convinced Harry that this was a good idea. Less than 6 months later, along with Dr. Ross Sugar, who had also reached out to Harry and also has early onset Parkinson's, we set out on the walk, the three of us, two trucks, and five guys in our road crew. 500 miles for Parkinson's took me on a 45-day adventure from a stable in the Bronx to a walk up University Avenue where we finished at Queen's Park. It wasn't easy, and it was amazing from start to finish. And it was definitely life-changing. The single greatest highlight on the walk was connecting with people who had Parkinson's or knew someone with Parkinson's. Every day of that 45-day journey, we met people who inspired us and who trusted Harry, Ross, and I enough to carry their story with us and to share our collective experience with others. Take Lynn and her husband, Paul, for example. We met them on the side of the road near Brighton, Ontario, when they tracked us down in their little red car after hearing that we were somewhere around their location. Lynn also has Parkinson's and was very excited to meet us and talk to us. We convinced them to join us on the walk, which gave us a chance to really get to know each other. Lynn, like Harry, has been living with Parkinson's for years. And like me, the new perspective she has gained from her experiences is something that she talks about quite openly. Lynn confidently introduces herself by saying, "Hi, I'm Lynn, and I don't have Parkinson's." And then she points at Paul and says, "We have Parkinson's." I teared up the first time I heard her say this, as it definitely resonated with me. Parkinson's, like many other chronic illnesses, is difficult to navigate on your own. A strong and supportive network of family and friends can make a huge difference in the life of a Parkinson's patient. Harry and I talked a lot about how lucky we were to have such amazing spouses and families, as well as others supporting us as we walked towards Toronto, although we could never have predicted the intensity of the support we received from those family and friends, including many members of this congregation. Almost daily after we began our walk in New York, we were joined by people on the road, family, friends, and often strangers. It was not all easy. Scary highways with seemingly non-existent shoulders in Upper New York State, rain, intense heat, seemingly endless hills in the Catskills, all provided physical and mental challenges that we were not necessarily prepared for. Remarkably, these things only strengthened our commitment and resolve to finish strong in Toronto. So many footsteps, so many conversations, so much time to think. I believe that every single one of us who were part of the 500 miles journey took time to really evaluate where we are at in our lives and where we want to go. One of the original goals for the walk was to motivate people living with an often misunderstood disease. Parkinson's can be very isolating. Balance issues, impaired speech, uncontrollable tremors and body movements make it easier to just stay home for many people. People with Parkinson's are often thought to be drunk or mentally challenged, and having to explain oneself or dispute these assumptions can be tiresome and embarrassing. As part of our outreach and awareness promotion, Harry and I visited a number of schools as part of our journey. One of the most touching scenes I witnessed was at an elementary school in Coburg, where a young boy came up to feel the battery pack and electrode in Harry's chest and neck as Harry explained to them about his deep brain surgery and how it had helped him manage some of his symptoms. At a high school in Belleville, the entire school joined us for our first mile of the day as we walked around the track at their school. We got a high five from almost every student in the school as we left the track that morning. We were inspired. If only the majority of people in society reacted to people who are different, like these children and youth, it would be so much easier for so many. Harry also set an ambitious fundraising goal of $500,000. A lot of us thought he was crazy. But as the recipient of a relatively new treatment at the time he underwent his deep brain surgery, Harry is anxious for others to share in the benefits of promising new research techniques. Our final donations totaled well over $800,000 and was split between three research centers, the Michael J. Fox Foundation, the Anthony Lang Movement Disorders Clinic at the Toronto Western Hospital, and Dr. Bressman's Clinic at the Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. Many in this congregation generously supported our cause, and I sincerely thank you. We are optimistic that our collective efforts will help move some of the cutting-edge Parkinson's research closer to frontline use with those who are diagnosed with this disease. So what does one do when they finish walking 500 miles? I handed in my letter requesting long-term disability leave from work to my principal in August. After 25 years of teaching and being in a job that I still loved, it was very difficult, but it was a necessary thing to do. So what am I doing now? Aside from being the best wife and mom I can be, I'm involved in a new program for Parkinson's patients called Rock Steady Boxing, a boxing-based exercise program that is experiencing huge growth and success with Parkinson's patients. 3 mornings a week, I let my coach Lita put me through the paces with 10 to 15 other Parkinson's patients. I never thought hitting something could be so much fun. It was the trusting voice in my head that got me connected with Harry and told me to take a long-term leave from work, 2 of the best decisions I have ever made. This is also how I ended up walking again 3 weeks ago at the Women's March in Washington with 500,000 people, including Irene Souk from our congregation and many other Canadians. It seems that walking is becoming a defining activity for me. This gathering of white middle-aged feminists, as it was inaccurately portrayed by Donald Trump, was unusual in its diversity. I recognize that as a white middle-aged woman, many would see my involvement in the march as a one-off adventure organized to help me feel like I was doing something good to help others. This is as far from the truth as it gets. marching in solidarity with members of the Black, Hispanic, and LGBTQ communities, as well as many other marginalized groups, not only strengthened my resolve to educate myself about their struggles and how to support them in their fight for equal rights, it also reminded me to consistently challenge the perspective through which I experience life and view the world. It challenged me to take a stand and put myself on the line to stand up for others and what I believe is right, however uncomfortable that may be. My challenge now is to make sure that my participation in the march is the beginning, not the end, of my budding political activism. There is lots to be done, both here at home and across borders. I have been blessed to quietly walk 500 miles for Parkinson's with Harry and Ross, as well as to march down the streets of Washington with 500,000 strangers. These were very different walks. Both have changed my life and my perspective on the world for the better. My challenge to each of you: where will your walk take you?
Thanks so much, Sue. We need to hear these kinds of stories. They shape our world and help make us who we want to be. So thank you very much. And I'm sure you'll be around after the service for a little while and people will want to speak to you. At this time, the youth are invited to continue their discussion about this and other matters in a different place. So the youth may leave at this time. Given that we're going to hear from two of our own members today, I decided to go with a very brief meditation, but I did want to try to tie together some of the underlying themes in the two talks. What do you see? According to today's story, John the Baptist was in prison. Unable to see what Jesus was doing, he asked his followers, his disciples, to check it out for him. When John the Baptist's disciples found Jesus, they also saw, apparently, the lame walking, the deaf listening, the blind watching, and they were very impressed. Maybe Jesus was the Messiah. But what do we see now that Jesus, the preacher who gave us turn the other cheek and give them the coat off your back? What do we see now that Jesus is no longer with us? Hijabs? I see hijabs sometimes. I saw hijabs at the mosque I worshipped at this past Friday with other non-Muslim religious leaders. We were there to show solidarity with the Muslims who are grieving a great tragedy on occasion of the murders in Quebec City. I saw hijabs there. I also saw them at the USA consulate earlier in the week at a demonstration against President Trump's shutting the US border to refugees. I also saw a burqa. To be totally honest, I have mixed feelings about burqas. What do you see? I see hijabs, I see burqas, and turbans. Especially in my mother's Brampton neighborhood, lots of Sikhs live there, long beards, flowing robes, and turbans. It's a different Brampton than the Bill Davis Brampton I grew up in. But it isn't only headgear. Over the past few years, I think you too, I have noticed more and more walkers. Have you noticed them too? They have the little wheels and the trays, right? And they double as chairs in a pinch. I see these walkers in malls. I see them on sidewalks. I even see them coming up church aisles. And you know what? I never used to see these when I was a kid. What do you see? Besides walkers, I see kids in wheelchairs. Some of them don't speak much, or maybe not at all. Some of these kids do not seem to be able to sit up straight, but others do. Some of those kids in wheelchairs are pushed, and some of these kids operate those wheelchairs on their own. And I've seen that not all the people in wheelchairs are kids. What do you see? I see white children with long blonde hair. Sometimes I would like to run my hand through their hair. All my grandkids, after all, have frizzy, kinky, black hair. That long blonde hair is strange to me. But obviously, I restrain myself. We all have to respect boundaries. Still, I see that blonde hair. We all see stuff on the outside. Sometimes it's decorative. Sometimes what I see is old and wrinkled. Sometimes I see religious symbols that point to deep and holy truths. Or when I see a burqa, for example, I wonder if maybe that's not a deep and holy truth there. I don't know. And sometimes I see people who are physically very different than me. What I see is important. And yet it isn't the main thing. Rindy Bradshaw runs a nonprofit called Teaching Awareness Through Puppetry. And one of the things that her puppets tell children when she visits them in schools is this. Her puppets say, "We're all different on the outside. Some of us wear glasses. Some of us have blonde hair or darker skin. Some of us use a wheelchair, but on the inside, we're all the same. We all have a heart and feelings. On the inside, we all want to have friends and be part of a community." So far, I've been asking you, what do you see? But now I want to know, did you hear that? On the inside, where it is hard to see, we're all the same. We all have a heart and feelings. On the inside, we all want to have friends and be part of a community. Making it so, embracing the lame and the blind and the deaf and those who had leprosy in Jesus' day, or embracing the stranger, the other, the differently abled, the colored, or religious, or social class that we don't belong to in our day. I mean, this is the main thing. The only path to greater love and peace and shalom looks like that stranger. Compared to even just 50 years ago, we do live in a brave new world that allows all these creatures, all these people to be seen. But only our prayers, our willingness to risk, only our open arms will make such people our friends and community members and maybe even leaders. Do you see? Amen. Let's join together in a few minutes of prayer. Gracious and loving God, our prayer is that the light of your word that we have read and the example of Jesus that we have seen, our prayer is that all of this stuff would please penetrate our hearts, so that whether we're selling insurance or widgets or raising our children or building or renovating homes or selling stocks and bonds, whatever we do, our prayer is that we can find and follow the path that love has laid out for us. Our prayer is that we will have eyes to see every person as an image bearer, as precious, as beloved already, and someone who can be loved even more. Someone for whom we can be a friend and a neighbor, an encourager, a cheerer on, as someone who can speak to us and heal us and embrace us. We know that it is not your way to magically fix our problems when we ask. And yet we know that you listen to us, and in Jesus, that we have seen from you a way for living that is good. We also come here this Sunday confused and angry, upset by everything that has gone down in Quebec City. And we just do not believe that that is us. And yet it is. Something that happens in our country, along with the murder early this morning in Greektown. Our prayer is that not only will we have the empathy to mourn, but that we will have the empathy and wisdom to get involved in local politics, with our police boards, with our MPs, with letter writing, with our neighbors, in any way we can to commend a different way. We're upset because of everything that's happening in the States. Shut doors and well, it disturbs us. And our prayer again is that people of goodwill and wisdom may find ways to express human compassion and love that surprise us and gratify us, even in that situation. So God, through your mysterious Spirit, inspire us, change us. Make us better citizens of this country and this world. Help us never to turn our backs on those who reach out to us. Help us to always embrace and be embraced. And as for us at Lawrence Park, in this small corner of Christendom and Canada, may we gather to love and worship and to find our way and contribute to offer a helping hand wherever we can. Amen. We're going to listen to Janet McLaren speak a few words at this time. Come on up, Janet. She's going to talk to us about L'Arche. I just want to say by way of introduction that Janet spoke this summer, and it was inspiring, and people wanted to hear more, and so I asked Janet to come back after Council decided to support the work of L'Arche through the second collection, which, just as a reminder to our collectors, we do have two collections today. I wanted to say that if you would like, during the next 4 weeks, and this is voluntary, we're not passing the plate to make sure you put something in it, but we're giving you an opportunity if you wish to take it. During the second collection, checks to L'Arche should be written to L'Arche, Canada, and you see how L'Arche is spelled there. They have sent their spirit dancers to lead us in worship in the past, so we know a little bit about them. We've heard Janet before, and now I ask Janet to introduce her work and L'Arche.
Good morning. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about L'Arche this morning, and I'm also going to share some photos. I've had this in my pocket the whole time, but decided not to take control of Sue's presentation in the middle. But I'm going to share some photos about L'Arche and talk to you a little bit about the community. So I am a member of this congregation, as John said, but also a longtime friend and supporter and admirer of the L'Arche communities around the world, and particularly those in Canada. So at L'Arche, communities bring together people with and without intellectual disability. And together, people live together, share life, learn from one another, and grow in friendship, which is a real key aspect of the L'Arche communities. The model at L'Arche is not one of caring for somebody else, but rather one of sharing life with one another. It's a very mutual coming together of equal human beings, and it really is a beautiful philosophy. A typical community at L'Arche might have four homes, where people share life. They go grocery shopping, they share dinner around the table together, and then there's a lot of time for fun and friendship. These guys are playing street hockey, and a lot of time for fun and friendship and belonging to the community. The larger community, which is now made up of, let's say, four homes and 2 day programs, is a place where everybody belongs. So all of the core members, that's the people with disability, and the assistants, the people who come and share life and live in the homes, everyone is part of a larger community of belonging. And in these communities, there's a lot of time for celebration. Each person is known. Everybody is helped to have their gifts celebrated and shared more broadly beyond the community. And there's sort of a network of friendship and belonging for everybody within the communities. The communities also have day programs. So this is a picture of somebody in one of the day programs. So people who live in the homes, but also others with intellectual disability from the nearby community, will come to the day programs. And there they learn together or they work together, sometimes in a woodworking shop, for instance. Many of the day programs are oriented with an artistic aspect to them, such as the one we're seeing a picture of here. So at L'Arche, life is lived with a lot of joy. Each person's supported to share their gifts and to have a very full life. And spiritual meaning is imbued everywhere. The person who started it, Jean Vanier, who I'll talk to you about in a minute, was a very spiritual, very religious person and continues to be today. And it's really amazing to see this daily lived spirituality that reflects the meaning and the wonder in day-to-day life. So I'm going to talk to you just a little bit about the history of L'Arche, because it's an interesting story that sort of illuminates what L'Arche is about. 50 years ago, Jean Vanier, there's a picture of him here more recently, he was the son of the Canadian Governor General. He had been in the Navy. He was working as a professor, philosophy professor here at U of T. And he was looking for really a purpose in his life and ended up in France, where he met two men, Raphael Simi and Philippe Sue. And these two men had intellectual disability and were living in an institution. And Jean was just overwhelmed by how sad their situation was. They were living behind walls with no freedom, no friends, no contact with anybody outside the institution. And Jean felt he needed to do something. And the something that he did is surprising and amazing. He bought a house. So this is a picture of Jean, Raphael, and Philippe outside of the house. He bought a house in rural France, and he invited Raphael and Philippe to come and live with him forever. And that's a pretty profound thing to do. But that was the choice that Jean made. They named their house L'Arche for the Ark, which is Noah's Ark, symbolic of everybody being safe in the Ark together. And together they started living. They cooked, they shopped, they did the gardening, and they had a lot of fun driving around France in Jean's car. But in these months, Jean made a discovery, kind of like, John, when you opened the doll. You know, he had seen the outside and he was willing to be charitable and dedicate his life to this purpose. But when he was living with Raphael and Philippe, he learned that there was something more. He learned that not only was he helping Raphael and Philippe, but they were helping him. And through their friendship and courage, he discovered how true it is that we are all fully human. And we are all equal. And he was a great philosopher, and he was a really religious guy. But it actually took living with Raphael and Philippe. These were his teachers who were able to teach him this profound lesson. And so Jean wrote about what he was learning. People around the world listened. People came, to L'Arche, and the communities grew. Right now, there are 149 communities around the world on 6 continents, so not one in Antarctica yet. Don't know when that's going to happen. And 29 of the communities are in L'Arche, Canada, and this is the group of communities I've been working with. So in Canada, you can see on the map here, they go from Cape Breton to Vancouver Island, and the closest one to us here is in the Danforth in Toronto. And that is where the Spirit Movers dance group, that's one of their day programs, and they've come to the church fairly often. One of the members of that group used to come to church here when she was growing up, so they have a connection back here to Lawrence Park. So these communities continue what Jean started in that first home, but with the insight, as people enter into it, the assistants who come to L'Arche are coming to it because they want to learn, to see, and to hear inside. And to understand what it is for everybody to be equally human. So people come together, they share life with one another, learn from one another, and are surrounded by friends and community. L'Arche in Canada supports 800 men and women who live in homes, and an additional several hundred people who come to the day programs in these 29 communities. I've had this amazing experience for the past 5 years of helping to support the leadership development of the community leaders and the assistants who are at L'Arche, and including, I'll show you here, Elizabeth is the community leader in the middle of this picture. She's from L'Arche Joliette, just north of Montreal, and she's just a lovely person who grew up with a brother who had intellectual disability and just wants to share, her certainty about how fully human and equally human we all are by living this joyful life. And she's one of the most joy-filled people that I've met, and she is one of the happiest people I've met, and she lives a very simple life in some ways, and a very beautiful life, as you can see in this picture, in many ways too. So to me, L'Arche is about radical inclusion. At L'Arche, it pushes the inclusion of people with intellectual disability to its very limit. What does it look like if we are truly all the same, if we are truly human beings? And doing that, a challenge of society, beyond just the living L'Arche within the communities, L'Arche has always been a challenge out to society to say, how else can we be more inclusive? How else can we be more compassionate? Where can our society be more just? So in L'Arche, the inclusion is lived out with a lot of laughs day to day in these 29 communities across Canada. And I think the challenge that it poses to us, hopefully, after listening today, everyone can leave with a little bit of that challenge from everything that's being said, just about how do we help support, this kind of justice and inclusion in our world today. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you for considering L'Arche, and thank you to Council for the opportunity for me to talk to you about L'Arche today. And I will be at the back with some envelopes for L'Arche if anyone would rather, if that's easier for people to write a check and send it right in that way. Thank you. Thanks, John.